Hey, everybody, it's Billy Hulting. Thanks for tuning in. We got a great show for you today with composer Ron Jones. You've all heard his work on Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Family Guy. We really get into the deep end of music while we discuss his long and interesting career. I think you'll really enjoy it. As always, the Jazz Roundtable is recorded in front of a live internet audience. I've edited a bit from the original show, like taking out reading chat room comments and tip shoutouts. They didn't seem to translate well into the podcast format, but everything else is here from the show. The shows are free, but if you'd like to leave us a little something in the tip jar, explain how to do that during the show. Please note, live at zerobpm.com is spelled live, ATZEROBPM.com. We always love it if you subscribe and leave a review. That really helps us spread the word. I want to make the show better, and you can help. Please send ideas to podcast at live at zerobpm.com. Thank you, and have fun listening.
Welcome to the Jazz Roundtable, brought to you by Live at Zero BPM, with your host, Grammy Award-winning percussionist and mallet player, Billy Hulting. Tonight's guest, Ron Jones. If you care to donate, click on the donate / tip jar link in the description or on our website at live@zerobpm.com/tipjar. You can also tip on Venmo at ZEROBPM. And now, let's get to the music with your host, Billy Hulting.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Jazz Roundtable. This is number 4. This is really excited and I'm really excited because Ron Jones, who's on the show tonight, I'm a big fan. I'm also a friend of his. This is going to be a really great night. As you know, we normally have like 3 guests on, but I wanted to give Ron a lot of time because he is just so prolific, not only in his career, but in what he has to say about music. And I think everybody's going to really enjoy this. So let me start off by saying it mentions how to leave a tip. We're entirely tip-based, the whole organization. So please look into that. We also have merchandise on the website. You can tip. I'll put the links in the chat rooms, but they're also in the descriptions up there. And also, while you're here, and I'm going to mention this again later on, but please, like the video on YouTube or Facebook or thumbs up or whatever they call it, or Twitch. And then also, if you want to subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Facebook, then you won't miss any of these things. We do the 1st, 3rd, and 5th Tuesdays are the Jazz Roundtable each month, and every Thursday night is live jazz, trios, quartets, and more. This summer, we're going to expand and do some things. But enough about this. Let's bring on Mr. Ron Jones.
Hey.
Hey, Ron, how are you tonight?
I'm fine. I've been looking forward to this. This is going to be fun.
Thank you. And I think you have won the grooviest shirt of the entire series so far. So another award to add to your...
the groovy shirts.
That's right. So... for those out there who don't know Ron by name, you've all heard him, his music, but, and most noticeably lately, we think of Family Guy and Star Trek, The Next Generation. But as an intro to Ron, Ron and I write back and forth, and he's been so helpful and it's fun to correspond with during the pandemic, because as you all know, we're all locked down. We're all trying to find ways to stay sane and everything. And Ron was writing me, and I hope this doesn't embarrass you, Ron, but you wrote this and it was just so poetic, I just wanted to read it to everybody. So forgive me for looking down, but I don't have it memorized yet. He says, musicians often need to be always in a flock, group, or a gathering. I am strange in that I chose to find some place 1,252 miles north of LA away from the flock. I always say the greatest composition is not the notes we put on a page or the music we make, but it is who we are, the inner music we create and even listen to. Regardless of what town a person lives in, each person must create a reality, a purpose, a meaning. Out of that equation and through unique human filters comes an art of the soul. What I have created here is my lab. The forest, the longer I know them, teaches many lessons. Different lessons than from coping with the crush of millions of people all fighting to climb an anthill. There is all that inner dialogue and insight also. So much to talk about in a short space of time. And then he says, the world hungers for meaning. Music is a vital part of that. And it really is. And I think that sums up Ron Jones. So thank you. Good night. And...
No, it was fun.
Yeah, and Ron's right. And you probably have, we'll get into a lot of things tonight, but before we get into, you know, your chronological history, what we talked about a lot over the past year is just how to find that creative process and stay sane during, you know, which is very troubling times for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I mean, you have to figure it out on your own. Like somebody next door that lives next door to me down the road has to figure out that they like knitting, or they like something. You have to have something you're excited to wake up and do, and you're excited to wake up the next day and do it again. And if you're not, then you really have compounded the problems.
Yeah, exactly. So I hope, I mean, most people that are listening to the show, I think, are musicians or have some musician background, so they probably get that on a different level. But it could be, you know, you love running, or you knitting, or it could be anything. There's no the limits to it. I'm hoping that most people have found a way to tap into that while they were gone. But let's go back and through a couple of go chronologically kind of thing. Well, first, you're an award-winning composer, and I see that the 2017 ASCAP Screen Music Award for Best Top Cable Television Series for The Family Guy. You have several Grammy and 5 Emmy nominations, which is awesome. You won a NERD Award in 1991, Best Soundtrack Album of the Year. And also, the Academy gave you it's a very long title, but they gave you an award in for 1998-99 for Star Trek The Next Generation. Do you have any new awards we don't know about yet?
Well, there's a bunch for a film that I scored. And actually, my sister was the creator of this film. And she lives in Rome. And she did a film because she loves Naples, about a history of Naples through the eyes of a young boy. And there's like a legend about a treasure. So she said, I'm doing this film. And I said, you know, I wrote this guitar concerto, and I think you should listen to that. You can use it if you like, you know, since, you know, we're brother and sister. And she tracked it and ended up filming the whole film to the second movement of the guitar concerto. And then it just won. She won like 70 awards around the planet, and we won best score in 3 of the, I think it was St. Petersburg, something in Hollywood, and something in the south of like in Cumbria in Italy. So, you know, there's always something. They sent me these goofy awards, you know.
Well, that's cool. So, you know, I want to go through your resume chronologically, or through your life chronologically. But one of the questions I had is, when Ron Jones was very young and you wanted to get into composing, what was the first sort of thing you wrote, and where did you get, who influenced you back then?
I was in Drum and Bugle Corps, which sounds dumb until you go see a Drum and Bugle Corps. Mm-hmm. You go see like the Blue Devils or Santa Clara Vanguard or somebody. It's like they're doing the Rite of Spring, and they're all marching backwards in 7/8, and there's like 30 percussion and giant horn lines, and you practice. So I came out of that kind of hardcore thing, and band was always too easy. You know, it was like nobody took band, you know, like nobody was as serious, because we worked really, really hard in drum corps. So when I would hear the horn lines warm up in the parades, and they'd be downtown Seattle, mm-hmm. the Seafair Parade. So I would wander around, and I listened to the horn sections warm up. And I remember hearing the Seattle Shamrocks do just a warm up. It was just like a B flat chord, E flat chord, you know, like huge chords. I said, I want to do that. And so I started doing takedowns of records and doing everything I can to learn how to do it. Then we finally, my family decided to move us to Oregon, my brother and I started a drum corps, which is still going after 50 some years, called the Oregon Crusaders. And so I had to write the drum parts, recruit the kids, tell the parents where we were taking their kids to on a bus, where their daughters were going to be. You know, we had to do all that. And we were kids. I barely had my driver's license. Mm-hmm. So that's where I started. I started in drum corps. And it's much like ballet, because every moment is scored. It's not like a marching band show and sloppy. It's tight, like the Bolshoi Ballet with music. So really, I that was easy to go into film scoring because film scoring was so similar to what we had to do with creating these shows that were played in stadiums.
Right. A bunch of guys I went to college with came out of drum corps, and so they got me into watching a lot of it. And it's actually pretty darn impressive. You wouldn't think, but it's more than a glorified marching band, and it's very cool. So let's see. So you moved to L.A. to go to the Dick Grove School of Music. Mm-hmm. How did you like that?
Yeah. Well, when I was getting ready to graduate, I knew in college I just wanted to get my degree just to prove that somebody in my family could get a college degree. I didn't really care about doing anything with it. I just wanted to do it to prove I wasn't stupid or something. And so once I got it, I kept looking at Eastman School for graduate stuff or Juilliard and different places. And really what I wanted was what Dick Rope was doing, which was about writing for records, writing for film, writing for TV, all that kind of Hollywood stuff. Was more my, and I thought I started a publishing company in college. They let us like get a loan at the bank across the street from the university. So I went over there and they said, you would like a loan? I said, yeah. What do you need it for? I said, well, you want to start a publishing company. Whereas most students would get it to buy supplies or pay tuition or whatever. I started a publishing company. And then I would sell the charts or what I copy by hand, make copies at the school printing place and go sell them at the jazz educators conference out of the trunk of my car. So I thought when I got back from a year at Dick Rose, I would come back to Seattle or Portland and just continue being a music publisher. But I ended up getting snagged into television.
And you started some of this while you were still at Dick Grove, right?
Yeah.
And this was animated series?
Yeah, well, see, to survive, Laurie worked at a Pizza Hut, my wife, and I, to carry my end, I copied music. So I copied for Zan Overall, who had people like Al Jarreau, Carole King, Hanna-Barbera, different accounts. We'd come over there. In fact, Al Jarreau lived next door. And all these different people were right on the same block in North Hollywood. So I started copying just to make some bread while I was going to Dick Grove. And a lot of the accounts, as I was copying, I said, I can do this. So that's how I would go to I would say, instead of paying a guy $40 on a motorcycle to drop the music off for the record date or the score, can I take it? So I just wanted to go in and see what was happening, you know. And so I started going to Hanna-Barbera, and I said, I can write this. And I circle all of the scores with red marks so that the composer kept, I mean, Hoy Curtin, the music director, kept going, what's all these red circles? He was going, what's with the red circles? Because I was critiquing the arrangers that they wrote the alto flutes too low, and I would write comments, all kinds of critiques. And finally, I had the nerve to go up to Hoyt during a break and say, Hoyt, you know those red marks? That's me. So after being slapped around in the hallway, I said, I'd really like to do this. I could do this. So, you know, that's how I kind of got in.
Now, back then, how did you deal with the timing for cartoons and timing and music? Was it all just, click track, or how did you do that?
Well, the way that they did it was very primitive because at that time, like they would be animating the shows in Australia and Korea and Japan and Czechoslovakia, and Hollywood would just be sending out those storyboards. So all these, you know, for budgets and everything, all these things are being done. So the composers, in order to get this mountain of music for, because Hanna-Barbera had shows on ABC, NBC, and CBS on Saturday morning. They just owned the airways. You had to create a lot of music. So we would just, the composers were handed a storyboard, which was like, it looks like a cartoon, you know, like if you bought a comic book and then it would have footage when you know, Johnny Quest would walk, they would say 6x6x6x, which meant six frames per walk. And then there would be dialogue, and Brace Banion or whoever the character would say, "Johnny, we've got to go find the professor." And you had no timings for that. So they didn't tell you anything. They just sent you home with that. So you had to figure out, the one thing was footage, film footage, like, you know, 24 frames per second. And then some were real time. So I had to use a stopwatch for the dialogue and math for the timings.
Okay, so you used a stopwatch. I mean, did you have a dialogue track and you would just time when they said things?
Yeah, they would hand you a cassette called a slug, mm-hmm. because what they would do is they would pre-record all of dialogue and stick it in there. That's how they could get the voice to match up. I mean, it was like they really needed to do a book about how animation was done in the 70s and 80s, because it was nutty.
It's like the Dark Ages.
It was, but it prepared me for working for Roger Corman, doing B films and all kinds of things.
Well, just so you know, we have a lot of people in the chat room, and Larie is here, and she says,
nice.
Footage, 3 feet equals 2 seconds. And so
I almost shot the coffee at my nose. Yeah.
So Dick Grove, and then you started working with Mike Post and Pete Carpenter. And I remember back in the day hearing that they had 13 primetime shows running all at the same time. So that must have been, that took a village to do all that, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, you know, you can't get into these. Like, everyone always goes, you know, how did you get in? Well, I was copying music for Hanna-Barbera, then writing music for Hanna-Barbera. And then the players like Vince DeRosa and Tommy Peterson and Tommy Johnson, all these different players said, "Man, you're really writing great stuff." And then they would go to Mike Post sessions and say, "Hey, Mike, there's this young guy that's writing his butt off. Do you want to hear anything from this Ron Jones guy?" And they go, no. And they just kept mentioning it because they go, this kid really knows what he's doing. So that then somebody would say, a French horn player would say, "Hey, Mike wants you to call on Thursday and give me a phone number." So it was always the players that championed me as a composer and arranger. It wasn't me. No, but no, I never had to call and make that direct call to get a gig.
Wow.
It was the players said they recommended, because always a recommendation is stronger than, "Hey, if you call up somebody and say, I sure am great. You know, and by the way, I'm really expensive and great.
Yeah.
And I'm very modest. So, and likable. A lot of people like me. So can I do your gig?" It doesn't work.
Yeah. No, I get that from going to jam sessions. You know, the cats that were actually out touring, there I'll be all these people that would come up and it's just like, "Man, I don't know you. You know, I'm sure you're nice, but my 40 best friends are drummers." But recommendations from somebody. In fact, that's how I started playing with you. It's because Emil recommended me, I think. And I
that's right. Yeah, Emil, you were his protege. And so when Emil couldn't make it, I said, "Well, who can I call, man? You're Emil." He says, "Well, call Billy." I said, "Billy, I got your number," and I called. I didn't need to hear you perform or anything. I just said, if Emil says call, Paul.
Yeah, it's who you know a lot of times in the business. And so, well, now with we talked about this a little earlier when you're working with Mike Post and Pete Carpenter, how there would be a whole bunch of you working on an episode. And the process, mm-hmm. like you said, sometimes they'd say, "Oh, do scenes 2 and 3, and somebody else is going to do number 1. So how did you keep it cohesive unless you guys were collaborating with each other on what was going to go on? Where did you get the themes, and how did they work with you guys on that?
Well, we had the themes for the show. Like if it was the A-Team, you'd have that ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. So I'd have the lead sheet for that. And then when you come in to spot a show, which is where you get to see, you know, where it started, and usually Mike or Pete spotted the shows, they would have the cue sheets typed up from the music editor and hand it out and say, "Here it is, and by the way, here's the lick." And usually Mike when we worked with Mike, he would make up the theme right then. I mean, right as we were meeting, he'd say, hang on, I need to give you a lick. And then he would hand it to his secretary, who would make a few photocopies and pass it out to me and three other guys. And they'd say the session's on Thursday at 2 o'clock at Evergreen or whatever. And, you know, you're on your own. So that's how we do it.
Wow. That's kind of cool. And just, you know, Laurie is, she's giving a little background history in the chat rooms here, which is really
nuts.
Oh, yeah.
No, her, follow her because she knows everything. I've slipped several notches.
We'll have her on the show next time. Behind the scenes with Ron Jones.
Yeah.
But she did say, okay,
real wives.
Here's something you left out of your story about getting the gig. She says, I was working at Universal Music Department and got the phone number to Pete Carpenter. Ron called him out of the blue and got the gig. So
yeah, no, that's true. She was involved in a lot of these things because she was working at these music departments.
Mm.
And so she would kind of get to know who's who, you know, who's what, because you got to know who to talk to.
Right.
And you got to have somebody in there. So, you know, study the CIA if you want to get in.
Okay. So Mike Post and Pete Carpenter, then you moved on to working with Disney on a bunch of projects. Yeah. What did you do there?
Yeah. Mainly a show called DuckTales.
Mm-hmm.
And Huey and Dewey and Louie and Uncle Scrooge go on these adventures. And basically, the template was ducks doing Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, and they would just each episode would go to Africa or go to the North Pole and encounter something, and then they're late for school. You know, that kind of thing. So, and what was cute about it was the ducks were so serious about the adventure, you know, but they don't have any pants on and they got, you know, these feather things. So like you can't, so the cuteness was you're looking at ducks, but they're trying to be serious. Thus the humor.
Comedy gold.
And so I couldn't be funny. There's not one funny piece of music. I never got to write ha-ha music. With the twa-twas and the trumpets and the wah-wah. I never, you know, people think of animation as being this kind of crude language of crap, you know, from the music. But Carl Stalling was very elegant. And he never did twa-twa.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a twa-twa in any of his music. And I would put Carl Stalling right next to Schoenberg or Stravinsky in terms of musicality.
Well, it's interesting. In your bio, there's a story that says somebody asks you about your approach, and you say that you respect the intelligence of your audience. You're not writing down to them. You're writing for them. And I think that's probably a good example of how you handled the DuckTales and all that.
The funny story is how I got that, is how I got DuckTales was Chris Montan, who was the music director at Disney,
mm-hmm.
was just hanging out at Evergreen, and we were recording. He was sitting on the couch. And I'm sitting on the couch, and he goes, he just turned to me. I don't know why he said anything. He just goes, hey, that's pretty good. I go, well, that's mine. And he goes, oh, you're doing stuff a little bit differently. It seems like you're writing serious music. And I said, yeah, because, you know, when you were 9 years old, didn't you think you were serious? Didn't you build great tree forts? You did. You weren't just going, I'm a stupid kid, you know. You're smart. And I don't write music to patronize anybody. So month goes by and all of a sudden I get a call from my agent and they said, hey, Disney wants you to show up for this. How did you get in with Disney? I said, I didn't know. I didn't even know who I was talking to.
Interesting.
So that's, isn't that weird?
That's crazy. And then after Disney, you got you started working on Star Trek, Next Generation.
Yeah. What a weird segue from doing freaking ducks to doing outer space with Picard and the space guys, you know. I mean, now, what I shouldn't have got that gig.
You shouldn't have?
No. Oh. I shouldn't have got it because, not because I couldn't do it musically, but because if you look at the common knowledge that you go, well, if you've done A, B, C, therefore the D is the next
one.
So mine was so far afield. It was going like, XYZB. You know, like you never would imagine. Now, you know,
I was a fan of the show because I like all the Star Trek stuff, and I really like that show. And one thing that is about the time when TV series were becoming very serialized. You know, back when I was a kid, you could watch an episode, you could watch any episode, and it made sense. And Star Trek was there was a little bit of running theme through the whole thing, but not these. The season wasn't one story all the time, so you had a different situation every week. And how was that? Did that make it more fun, or because you weren't just doing the same thing over and over again, or how did that feel? With
well, there's different approaches to it. I mean, the when you have a serial like Dallas, this TV series Dallas taught everybody in network television a big lesson about how to capture an audience, and then you had Who Shot JR to have a cliffhanger. So Star Trek Next Generation was basically a soap opera in space. So I called it Space Condo, was my name for it. And in Space Condo, like, what are we doing this week? And Dennis McCarthy treated it like it was a continuing, like a continuum, another day in space. For me, it was every show was a different show, different themes, different tonalities, different tone rows, different band. And so my approach was different. And so to me, I go, what's the feature this week? And I would walk in and just be ready to do a completely different thing than last week. There was, so if you listen to my music, it'll always surprise you. You know, there's elements about, like, you know, it cuts to this, to the ship in space, and you'd have the bum ba 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 ba, you know, as it's coming in. And I evolved that theme of Alexander Courage. By season four, I wasn't using any bum ba ba. Everything was my theme, because the story of the characters evolved from season to season. And some of them died, like Tasha Yar died, like in the first part of the third season. So you couldn't have a continuum. You know, are you the same person this week as last week? No. Different molecules, different everything. We lose skin, you know, like we're different. So my approach was different. And the funny thing is they allowed that.
Oh, that's good.
And now I couldn't get away with it.
And then after Star Trek, you started doing Family Guy. And did you also do American Dad as well?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, the American Dad came out of the success of Family Guy. They said to Seth MacFarlane, they said, can you make another hit? And he goes, yeah. So that's where that came from. And, you know, it's just his genius that he could come up with that. But we started, but there was a gap between finishing Star Trek and then I did a bunch of other things. I did some video games, some features, some documentaries, different things. And then all of a sudden, there's always a gap of 3 years between, because when you do a series for many years, all of the producer friends you made leading up to that now think you're busy.
Oh.
So they've all hired other composers, other friends, and now you're the awkward character. Like, hey, how's it going, Jim? And Ron, hey, yeah. You know, like everything's awkward because now it's like having a new girlfriend, you know, and you know, you don't want to talk to the old girlfriend or the old guy. You know, it's like... It's like bad dating, you know, it's like, okay, so you have to start fresh. So it takes a few years to kind of come out of it.
It's not too dissimilar than what we used to call the dreaded road disease, where you couldn't tell anybody you were touring. Because if they thought you were touring, they would never call you because they just assume that you toured 365 days a year. So it was always a challenge.
That's right, so the contractors will never call you.
Yeah. I do remember when the cell phones came out that were no roaming, no long distance. And I forward my number to my cell phone, and people would call, and I would just go, oh, no, I can't make it Saturday night. I could be standing in Hawaii or Montana or wherever. I'd just say, exactly. Yeah, no, I've already got a gig that night. And that helped.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. No, it's very true, because everybody wants you to be available now. You know? You don't call a plumber and say, you know, anytime, man, you know, just let the toilets overflow, you know, just whenever, dude.
Yeah.
You want them now.
Exactly. So
now.
We're going to get to your recent projects, but I kind of want to get into some just musical questions to ask about process and that sort of stuff. Now, how do you work at such a high level, you know, when you're with the incredible time constraints of like live TV, or not live, of TV shows and even film? Do you have a process for, you know, getting the work done?
You know, I studied quite a bit peak performance in athletes, because I would find myself in these pressure things where I had to perform at a high level, and I would go to the emergency hospital so many times that they just had they go, "Hi, it's you. Okay, great. Go in IL-5, you know, with the bass players, you know," and yeah. I would know where to go at St. Joe's, because we would get dehydrated and start to hallucinate, and we couldn't hold the steering wheel anymore and stuff, because you've been staying up for 3 days, 3 nights. And I said, you know, I got to figure a way to do this without dying.
Mm-hmm.
So when I study peak performance, you know, if you want to go out for the Olympics in 4 years, you sit down with your coaches and they plan out your weight training and your distance training and your speed stuff. And to where finally, like, you're not doing your event till you're getting really close. And then when you're doing really close, you're not doing weights. You're doing only the fast stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to the actual venue, you're just putting on earphones and imagining your best performance as a pole vaulter. So I got to know Jim Lehrer from Sports Science. He's like the top guy for all the tennis players and golfers. And worked with him on a couple of things and read all his books. And I learned a lot about peak performance. And so what I do is I immediately jump into gear. Like, I'm immediately, when there's a show coming, I'm sort of like that athlete that's preparing for an event.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got it to where, for instance, you're always facing a blank page. How do you face a blank page? You know, like as a painter,
yeah.
As a poet, as a writer, as a somebody creating a film, that's the hardest thing possible. So I'd know to create my material. I'd know to break down the script. I had a routine. I say, what is this show about? Even if it was the 200th episode of a series like Family Guy, I'd say, what's this show? And I'd say, well, it's a family. It's dysfunctional. And I would like pretend like I didn't know the show, that I didn't know the characters.
Mm.
And they'd say, what's the main character? What are they all about? And then page four is like, if that character or that emotion was a theme, what would it be? If that character was a rhythm, what would it be? If that character was a harmony, what would it be? So meanwhile, I'm like Wagner. I'm creating this leitmotifs, and I have pages and pages and pages of themes sitting on my piano, on the left side of my piano. Always on the left side. And I'd have score paper to the right. I could sit on my chair and basically get anything I needed. So I go boom, 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 you know. So I tried to make the ergonomics and the whole flow of it work, because otherwise, if you're not disciplined to know how to approach the art and craft, you're never going to get anything written. You know, you're never going to get the job done, let alone excel at the music. I mean, you know, it's one thing just to say, oh, I finished it, I didn't die, and the producers are happy. But I'm not trying to please the producers. I'm trying to please me, an audience of one, and I have high standards. So I'm trying to write the best music that week that I've ever done in my life and see if I can top myself. So you have to be organized. Let me just put that in a nutshell. You have to be ready, you know, mm-hmm. and it's an event just like the pole vault or going out for the football teams, specialty teams, you know, people that just kick the field goal and they always make a field goal. They pay them $5 million to just make it through those little thing. Do you think that those guys that are the specialty kickers, they have five coaches. Mm. And on their, and when they have their off time, they go to clinics to check their eyes, to work on their feet. They do computer modeling. Wow. So why do people think that music just happens like a fart?
Yeah.
You know, we just make shit up like Mozart, you know. Mozart had a method. He had a great ear, but and Charlie Parker, he practiced his ass off. Like everyone thinks that just happened. He practiced 10 hours a day in elevator shafts, you know. So the whole notion that it just happens is wrong. And anybody that tells you that just happens, oh, I just feel it, is giving you a con job.
Well, let's talk about the Jazz Forest. This is your smaller jazz band project. Because you had the Ron Jones Big Band here in L.A., and now you're doing the Jazz Forest. And how would you describe the Jazz Forest?
Well, when we got up here to the Northwest, and we have 22 acres, I didn't have a band. I didn't have anything. I was just trying to get plugged in, get my studio going. And I would go for walks with a dog that we adopted, who's a real hunter of squirrels and rabbits and everything. And we're out on the far trail, and I kept kind of imagining, what if the squirrels would come down and play saxophones and just improvise? You know, like I had this weird, you know, fantasy. And so the first idea came from about the creatures in the forest coming together. That was the Jazz Forest. Mm. And it was a special place, and I tried to create this imaginary land where things would happen. And in that imaginary land, there was always a symphonic size string section, 7-piece rhythm section, and then a bunch of great soloists that also played ensemble. Ah. So with influence band, we had the 4 French horns and all that. So we had 24-piece band, you know, huge. And we could barely fit into the jazz clubs, but it was sort of like playing charts and people drinking, you know, scotch and trying not to fall off the stand. It was kind of fun. And we weren't trying to break any new ground, but try to give everybody a fun night for the band and for the audience. Whereas Jazz Forest, to me, it was sort of like symphonic expressions like Gil Evans.
Well, let's play a little bit. I have some video. Well, this is a video. If you want to set this up, this is North by Freaking West, which is the name, the title of your album. Let me just show the album here. Ah, there it is. And this is so old school. Ron didn't send me the graphic. I actually scanned this off of the album. So that's because we're old school here. I will have the links up for this. It's on Bandcamp, right?
Yeah. This one is still on iTunes.
Okay.
But there's 3 other ones on Bandcamp.
I'll have the links to all of that in the show notes when you get to that. But this is set this up for us, because this is not just, it's not a music video as such, but it's your title track. And, or should I just play it and they'll just figure it out?
When I was writing it, Marie, who's in the other room in the house, said, "That's not jazz. Why are you?" She knew I was writing charts to build for this group I was going to start. And she said, "Boy, that doesn't sound right." I said, "No, it's an homage to Bernard Herrmann, you know, who did North by Northwest, Vertigo, Psycho, all these things, which had these loops, and he would use little rhythmic cells. So this one it's in 6/8. So I used this Afro-Cuban lick that would just repeat and develop as it went. So it goes through all these phases, but it has this kind of late 1950s spy versus spy kind of feel. And so when we did the video, I told the filmmaker, I said, I want you to do an homage to Alfred Hitchcock. Mm. So we copied verbatim, you know, like the main titles for North by Freaking West, by North by Northwest and all that stuff. So that's what the joke is.
Okay. And so you can, I'm going to have the link to the full video. If the, you're listening to the podcast, go find it and watch it because it's very, very cool. So here, let me play North by Freaking West.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's just a taste. There's more to the video, and now, then you got to go find a link so you can see how it ends, right?
Yeah. Hey, it was fun, and that was Pete Christie on the tenor, and we had Chuck Finley on that, and
yeah, let me. I can pull
it's
up.
It's kind
the,
of a fusion of LA guys and Northwest guys.
Yeah, I mean Chuck Finley, Jeff Koshua, Pete Christie. You know, just there's Brad a ton Duke. Of guys on here. And Brian Monroney. I used to be on tour with Brian Monroney. That was a million years ago.
Oh, really? Guy. Oh, nice. Yeah.
And he's a composer arranger himself.
And he's in West LA and West Seattle. And he's busier. You know, he has his own little studio.
I got to give him a call, say hello. It's been a long time. But Rich had a great comment about how we grew up with the real music and without auto-tune and all this stuff, and kids today don't know, you know, everything. I think he made a comment about sports themes are just the highest, fastest, loudest songs in the world now. It's just
we didn't tune anything back then. There was no tuning at all. You just show up and play, you know.
That's great. And now, Laurie had a comment. And she says, that he, this is probably about Star Trek, said, yes, it is. He would usually not get any sleep the last 3 days before the sessions for Star Trek Next Generation. He was writing for 70-plus musician, takes a lot of time. He said, trust me. But, you know, you survived, so you did stay healthy.
And see what happened?
Exactly. So now the Jazz Forest, that's, you know, you guys had all the cats. We said Chuck Finley, Pete Chrisley, just all the guys. And is that Dave Tull on drums on that one?
Dave played on a bunch of the tunes on that, on Jazz, on North by Freaking West. That was Matt Jorgensen from Seattle.
Okay. And now I have
one of the owners of Origin Records.
Oh, okay. Well, I have a clip of the band live. This is the song I Want to Take You Higher.
Yeah.
And this is from Seattle, a gig up there?
Yeah, we were in a place where Jimi Hendrix used to play in Seattle.
Wow. Okay, let me play a little clip of this one. Live at Zero BPM audience here for the even for the Jazz Roundtable shows. So.
It's nice. It's a nice audience.
Yeah, they're very polite and they're very good. So, but that was really cool. Let's see, and I have a bunch of clips, and I've got some clips and tracks from the album. But you know, I was going to ask a question. You do so much classical composition, and you're working on an opera right now.
Yeah,
doing everything remote. Can you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, when the pandemic hit, you know, we built a studio here that I could put 40 people in, and we haven't had one person other than my MIDI assistant who comes once a week, and he's wearing a mask, I'm wearing a mask. They say you can't get people in a room to do anything, you know. I mean, it's difficult. So I had to start either give up or call people remotely. So I would call Fred Seldon, or I would call, you know, people in LA. There's a singer. Since I'm doing an opera, I needed singers. I tried to do it without singers. You can't do an opera without singers, you know. So I called session singers because they understood recording and they had recording setups at home, you know, but the opera singers don't have that. They don't think like that. So you can't get them. So I had to get people that were doing feature films to sing the opera parts. And that was a real challenge. But and then I did a whole bunch of symphony things. So I'm almost done with two albums in the last year that we've been cloistered here.
Now, when you're writing for jazz or you're writing for opera, how much of what you've learned from both influences across, or do you segregate them and just do that? Or do you, you know, how much experience, I mean, what's the word? How much influence, cross influence is there with all that?
Well, with classical music, there's no requirements because people have stopped thinking that it's the main thing, right? So we're on the fringe. We're like, polkas are more exciting and more have a bigger following, polkas do, than classical. So we get to kind of do what we want to do, and they went through the avant-garde and all that. Whereas jazz, there's much more adventure that was going on in the 60s and early 70s than there is now. Now it's sort of about getting airplay, and so everything sounds like R&B, pretty much. It's an R&B bag with improvisation, and then there's these fringe ends of it, like people that are, well, let's call them like crazy out, you know, with things, and there's people that are traditional. So they're all trying to sell their product, you know, and trying to, so if you're in the 60s, the more out you were, the more product you sold.
Right.
Now, the more out you are, the less you sell. So jazz is dependent on those kind, you know, venues and audiences and selling albums and concert tickets. So they have to do a certain amount of sucking up. So I find that with the doing, say if I was a painter, after a while you get tired of painting the same boat and the sunset and the thing, you know, like, so there's a formula to any bag. And so, you know, with jazz, you state the melody with everybody, and then everyone gets to solo, and then you come back and there's a coda. I mean, I got ill from that.
It's another,
you know, I got really sick. Yeah. And certainly I can appreciate it. You know, it's great. It's like, I did a lot of things with Jazz Force, which were homage to the greatest people, to Coltrane and to all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, like here we did in my jazz band, we did like Sly and the Family Stone. And then we would do something from, you know, a very famous jazz piece that everyone would know, because I don't see the limits.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then the audience goes, well, why are you doing that? You know, why are you cranking that out? And I go, look, dude, jazz is supposed to be a four-letter word. It was a cuss word that the aristocracy used to make fun of jazz. It's like saying horse poop, you know? And so why do people they've elevated to some kind of academic level to where it's sort of like we're messing with the theory of relativity if you mess with jazz, because it's like everyone says, yes, we've solved the equation. It should always be these things. Mm-hmm. It should always be this long. I remember when I first started passing out the charts with Jazz Force, they would be reading their crazy, you know, Seattle players, they'd be reading. And then we get to the solos and they get lost because they go, aren't we going to do the same changes that were at the beginning? Ah. I go, no, I had completely different changes for the solos. Now that's breaking the rules. In classical, they don't care. They just want it to be great, and they want it to be interesting, and they're snobby, but they want it to be. When jazz sort of wants, they go, look, this is a church. You got to do it according to the verse and chapter of how it is, or you're not considered correct. So I broke every rule. We had five guys in the AV team for my band. We had 11 in the band, or 12 sometimes. He had two guitars. It's against the law to have two guitars in a jazz band. You know, I mean, you could be arrested in seven states for that. So, and one of them's Washington, you know. Yeah. So I had two guitars, and like they're looking at the guitar players, looking at each other. Wow, you're playing something different than what I'm playing. Yeah, I wrote, you know, I tried to write it. So I took Hollywood writing and applied it to that creative canvas. So, you know, and we would sell out almost every venue we played at, but I think people were always bewildered as to what I was doing.
That's cool.
At least I hope so.
That means you're doing it right.
I hope so. I hope so. Yes, but that certainly doesn't help to support the band. You know, like if you're concerned about, if you're not caring about making bread, that's the way to go.
Yeah. Now, you also started the Revel Study Group in LA, and I went to several of those, and you were talking about, well, you started out with the Revel score, but I also was there for part of Stravinsky, and then you got into Star Wars as well, and you would break it down into different things. And I had a question. Maybe it's a personal question, but I think other people might understand it. It's like when, because you used to say, if you ever want to do this, you know, cut out this 5-bassoon thing from the Rite of Spring, put that on your refrigerator. And if you ever need something that sounds like, you know, so I was wondering if you just listen to a piece and find a bit that speaks to you in a certain way and say, okay, I've got to figure out, study what that was. Or if, and maybe both of these, while studying a score, you may find a nugget in there that you may not have noticed just listening to it and said, wait a minute, I can take this and then expand on it.
Yeah. You know, the wonderful thing to say about the Broadway in New York is that mm-hmm. everything happens like in about 10 blocks. And so all the playwrights go to everybody else's plays, whether they are doing that bag or not. And so everybody knows everything. So they're picking up and evolving. You know, car companies, they go out and buy all the other car companies, but Toyota buy all the Toyota models and tear them apart and say, you know, I like the way they do the upholstery. You know, so you're always trying to learn from the people that are doing it. So like right now, Larry always goes, you know, how come you're spending so much bread on buying scores? And I'm studying Joseph Schwantner pieces, and I'm studying Prokofiev, and I'm studying everybody all the time. I have a stack of scores that I'm always having to get through because I'm still picking up lessons from these guys. There's still things to be learned from Bach. And that applies to jazz or classical or whatever you're doing.
Cool. So I'm going to play. Oh, now, going back, because you're talking about the studio and how you have this big place, and hopefully as things open up, you'll be able to put 40 musicians in there at once. But I kind of have, the sizzle reel of Sky Muse. That's Sky Muse Ranch. Is that what you call it?
Yeah, well, before you play it, imagine, you know, in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where Richard Dreyfuss kept seeing this plateau and he would mm-hmm. make it out of mashed potatoes or right. he would get chicken wire. And when I left Hollywood, I kept envisioning making 20th Century Fox. So when you see the video, you see that I did kind of like 20th Century Fox in the woods. If you only had a million.
Yeah,
I needed a billion, but I had a million. Okay, so this is what you do with a million if you wanted to create 20th Century Fox.
Okay, well, I'm just going to play a snippet. This is like an 8-minute video, but I'll have the link to the whole thing. But let's just watch a little bit of the Sky Muse.
Okay.
What can you do?
Just go knock on some other door. Because he loves me. Now nothing else matters in the least. My hunger for life has just increased. Because he's the beast. I get to be the beautiful.
My part. You came to dry my tears,
take away my fears. I give you all the treasures of my heart.
Yeah, I just want to grab a couple of clips because you're doing so much cool stuff up there. And that last bit, the way you look tonight, where was that filmed?
There's a senior center on Kamano Island. It's an island out in the Puget Sound.
Wow.
And we would play there regularly, like one or two times a year. And they have a jazz series. Like here we are in this little town with like 5,000 people, but on Kamano Island, there's 35,000. And there's a jazz series.
Wow.
So I said, you know, it'd be fun to bring my band there. And they go, what band? And they humored me. And so I bring in a big band. And, you know, Jazz Force would play there. We always had like, you know, the place holds like 100 people. We'd have 200 people. You know, we'd break the fire code. But it's just out on these little islands, you know, out here.
That's great. And we're getting kind of towards the end of the day here, but I did have a question for you. And this is kind of open. This is not something we discussed before, but what advice or would you have for people who maybe don't listen to jazz but want to get into it and or don't understand classical or just music in general? What would you say to someone like that if they wanted to understand more about what's going on?
The thing is, we humans sang before we made language. Our first language was singing, and we communicated. So all that is stored in us. All those, like even the way we hear is an overtone series. There's a nerve that goes in the auditory part of the brain, and it has a fundamental, and then the octave, and then the just like the overtone series, because we were built as a reflection to the music and the sounds around us, bird calls, everything. So I would just say, you know, find the music that you enjoy, that you love, and listen to a lot of it, because music is about hope and possibility, and it's cathartic. You know, you can either pay $100 an hour for a therapist, or you can listen to Coltrane, you know, because it takes your soul on a journey, and you have to pick out meaning from it. You say, you know, that bass part means something to me, and the way that you like it is cool. It doesn't you don't have to like it like somebody else. You don't have to like it like me, you know, like the maniacs. You just have to like it. Like if you just love albums of triangles, people playing triangles, dig it, you know, dig it, or get a harmonica or something. But it's part of our brain, and it's the part of the brain that's attached to our emotions. These little ear holes go directly into the emotions. So if you want to alter your emotions and you're feeling sad, play happy music, and in 5 minutes, you'll forget what you were angry about. And if you want to be sad and you were happy, then like we can do that too. It's like, I always think of myself as the minister of propaganda, is that I know how to push all those buttons using major, minor, suspended clusters, orchestration. Mm-hmm. So use that on yourself, like compose what you're going to listen to. You say, you know, I'm going to make Thursday a great day, and I'm going to listen to blah, blah, blah. And, you know, make an appointment with yourself to listen. I mean, you're always an audience of one, whether you're at Carnegie Hall or sitting at home in your studio or in your home. You're always an audience of one listening. So just jump in.
Well, I think we will end the show there on that note.
We just got started.
Well, I'll have you back, Ron. We'll do a part two.
I want to interview you next time.
Okay. And we're going to have Laurie on next time as well. So she actually, yeah. Now I have to do a correction. She said that the Trust Me was about North by Freaking West. So I think not being jazz and everything. So thank you. I stand corrected. A couple of the comments. Chris Stark, who's a guitar player, composer, friend of mine in Hawaii, he says, what does every great practitioner have in common? A devotion to lifelong learning, which is just the embodiment of that. And Brad Dude says, thanks, Ron, for mixing the percussion so loud.
Of course. We couldn't put 9 tracks of you on there and ignore it.
But I just want to say thank you, Ron. This has been great. You're fantastic. We could really just go on and on and on, but I try to keep the shows an hour-ish.
Thank you, Billy.
And next time we'll do some more playing. We'll do some more talking. Maybe we'll have some other guests on as well. But Laurie is like going, no, don't end it. I'm sorry.
You could interview Laurie.
Yeah, I definitely want to. I want to get the inside scoop from Laurie.
He's got the real story.
It'd be a great show. Just, you know, significant others, the people. So I want to thank everybody that tipped. And you know, if you're watching this on an archive, you're listening to the podcast, the tip jar is up forever. So there's anytime you want to do that. But I will say thank you again once more to Ron Jones.
All right.
There's our polite.
Thank you, Billy. Thank you, gang.
And I will see you all. I'll see everybody Thursday, but let me just play where is the outro here? And I'm going to say goodnight, everybody.
Thanks for joining us at Live at 0 BPM. These videos will be archived on YouTube and Facebook, so tell your friends. These Jazz Roundtable shows will also be released as a podcast, so please subscribe. Coming up on Thursday, May 4th, it's the Jazz Roundtable number 5, Guitar Night, featuring Pat Kelly, Joe Robinson, and Vinnie Raniolo. Showtime, 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And as always, it's free, though donations are greatly appreciated. Go to live@0bpm.com for details and to sign up for our mailing list. Also, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. See you soon!